This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Welcome to SciPod, your audio guide to the most intriguing stories in science and technology, as gathered and reported by the staff of New Scientist magazine. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the April 14th edition of SciPod, Supercharge Me, the curiously beneficial effect of running an electric current through your brain. Bracing for disaster. Why the coming century could be far more dangerous for San Francisco than the last one. And it's a great view, but the room service ain't cheap. We check into the Space Hotel in this week's Science News. Are you the type of person who likes to feel plugged in? If so, then we have just the experiment for you. Researchers have discovered that direct current brain polarization, which literally means strapping an electrode to your head and zapping it with a weak electric current, can improve cognitive performance. Now, we don't recommend you try this at home, but the results are generating excitement among scientists, and they could someday lead to treatments for certain kinds of brain disorders. To find out more, New Scientist Ivan Semenek spoke to Dr. Eric Wasserman, chief of the Brain Stimulation Unit at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke.
Dr. Wasserman, I'd like to know more about this procedure that you're using in your studies, direct current brain polarization. Can you tell us what that is?
It amounts, in effect, to hooking a 9-volt battery between two places on the head and passing a weak direct current through the brain such that one of the brain areas is charged positively and one negatively.
Now, I'm sure a lot of our listeners might be thinking this isn't something that would naturally occur to them to do. So what is the history of this?
Well, it has a very long history. I don't know how they first noticed that it had effects, but it was sort of a natural thing for people to try as they began to be able to manipulate the environment of the brain in animals. And then later in people, there was always a feeling that the brain was an electrical organ and that electrical fields might affect its function. I sort of pick up the story in the 1960s when people were able to measure the activities of individual nerve cells. And at that point, they found that manipulating the electrical environment could cause nerve cells to fire faster or slower.
And I want to ask you about those effects. But first, 9 volts sounds relatively modest, at least at first pass. What does that actually translate into in terms of how much electricity is passing through a subject's brain?
Well, the voltage isn't really what matters. What always does the work in biological systems is the current that one is able to put through the tissue. In this case, the currents that we're working with are in the milliamp range, that's a thousandth of an ampere, at the surface of the head. And a great deal of that current is actually being shunted through low resistance tissues outside of the brain. We estimate that perhaps half of that is actually going into the tissue. And the other thing to consider is that our electrodes are quite large, so that current is diffused over a considerable area, and that further reduces it. However, for the system that we're looking at, and we don't really understand what its components are, the types of currents that we're working with seem to be sufficient to change nerve cell function.
So when you experiment with human subjects, what kind of changes do you find?
Well, the first experiment that we did with this was to apply it to the left prefrontal cortex, an area that's involved in choosing behavioral responses. And a typical test that you might use for the state of that area would be to have people make lists of words in certain categories, for instance, those beginning with a certain letter. What we did in our experiment was to put the anode, that is the positively charged electrode, over that area and see if we could affect people's ability to make word lists. And what we found was when we applied anodal current to the left prefrontal cortex, people were able to come up with words faster and, in effect, make longer lists.
You know, I have to say there's a spooky quality to this. If, as you say, the application of direct current seems to be enhancing the performance of your subjects, how does that feel to them? You know, what are they reporting?
Some of our subjects in the experiment that I just mentioned did notice that they were performing a little bit better. But we haven't done experiments, for instance, to compare this effect to the effect of having a good night's sleep, a cup of coffee, chewing gum, or any of the other things that have actually been shown in the past to enhance performance as well.
Well, in terms of the physiological underpinnings of this, do you know what's going on? Why does direct current have this effect?
It does something to alter the electrical environment of neurons. And it could do this by causing a change in the shape of a membrane protein that might be involved in the flow of ions across the nerve cell membrane. And that's how nerve cells fire anyway. So if you were to cause a small change, there are neurons can be in certain states, that is the state of charge and activity across the membrane, where they're particularly susceptible to small changes in the environment and can respond with fairly dramatic changes in firing. My best guess at this point, and this is not based on a lot of data, is that we are causing a change in a membrane protein.
Now, all of this is fascinating enough from a fundamental science point of view, but what are the possible applications of this? Can it help people with brain damage, for example?
Well, there have been studies looking at combining this technique with intensive physical therapy-like training in patients who have had strokes. And there is a benefit. It does help. It does help people produce sort of incremental improvements in the function of limbs affected by stroke. We have begun trying it in degenerative brain diseases, such as frontotemporal dementia, and have not seen very much there so far. But I think it is a very promising technique in a number of areas, especially combined with various behavioral manipulations such as practice, or perhaps in enhancing function in healthy people who are performing critical jobs.
Now, Dr. Wasserman, I can just imagine that you must get a very diverse reaction to some of this work. And I'm imagining that there must be a lot of interest, too. I mean, do you think there is a deeper interest in enhancing brain function? And if so, is this work leading us in that direction?
I think there's tremendous interest in that sort of thing. But I think the ethics can be summed up in terms of fairness and social benefit. Obviously, it is not ethical to advantage one group over another, say college students who could afford a technique like this or had access to it over their peers. I don't think that would be an appropriate application. However, if we were talking about neurosurgeons, fighter pilots, or long-distance truckers, where the benefit is really to the society as a whole, there, conceivably, there would be a legitimate ethical application.
Well, Dr. Wasserman, it's certainly an exciting line of research, and as you say, it opens up into some very interesting issues. Thanks for telling us about it.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you very much.
We reached Eric Wasserman in Bethesda, Maryland, and if you'd like to know more about direct current brain polarization, you can read all about it in this week's issue of New Scientist magazine. And don't forget to put your thinking cap on.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now, from the London office of New Scientist, here's Caroline Williams with this week's science news.
You can't book a room just yet, but it looks like the first hotel in space is one step closer to reality. A Las Vegas, Nevada company has reserved slots on two Russian rockets, due for launch later this year. Each rocket will carry an expandable module into low Earth orbit. Once aloft, the modules will inflate to their full 5-metre length. The goal of the project is to test the feasibility of inflatable habitats in space, a concept once considered for a NASA space station, but never developed. Now Bigelow Airspace, a private company owned by American hotel entrepreneur Robert Bigelow, has seized on the idea as a way to create the first orbiting hotel. The long-term plan is to launch several modules, each 3 times larger than those being tested later this year. Once in orbit, the modules will be linked together to create a space hotel. Eating farmed salmon can be a great source of omega-3 fatty acids, but there's a catch. Salmon also need omega-3 fatty acids in their diet, and they usually get it in the form of fish oil from wild-caught fish. This means that the expanding salmon farming industry is hastening the depletion of wild fish stocks. Now researchers at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, have hit upon a solution. The researchers found that Chinook salmon grow normally and exhibit normal activity, even if 3/4 of the fish oil in their diet is replaced with canola oil. The veggie diet also helps keep farmed salmon free of PCBs and other toxins that are passed on from wild fish. The results were presented at a recent meeting of the Society for Experimental Biology. And finally, just in time for Easter, a new technique could help farmers spot which freshly laid eggs will later crack, long before they get anywhere near the packing plant. The technique was developed by a team of British and Belgian researchers and involves a machine that uses a pulse of sound energy to acoustically tap each egg. Eggshells that are free of fractures will resonate differently from those that are flawed. By analysing the frequency of the resonance, the sensor can predict the likelihood that the egg will crack. Cracked eggs are not only a significant cost to farmers, they also pose a hazard to consumers because they can allow entry to dangerous bacteria. The new egg sounding machine will be described in an upcoming issue of British Poultry Science.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcast@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show.
100 years ago this week, the ground beneath San Francisco started shaking, and an epic disaster, one of the worst in modern history, was soon underway. The 1906 earthquake virtually destroyed the city. But its aftermath gave rise to a new era in earth sciences. Jessica Marshall is with the San Francisco Bureau of New Scientist. This week, she took a trip across the city and back through time to find out what was learned a century ago and what it all means for the city that today stands on the ashes of 1906.
This beach in San Francisco looks westward over the Pacific. It's a beautiful view, but it also hides the threat of disaster. On April 18, 1906, at precisely 5:12 in the morning, a stretch of ocean floor just 3 kilometers from where I'm standing began to rumble. Suddenly, a massive section of the Earth's crust was in motion all along the northern San Andreas Fault. The magnitude 7.9 earthquake reverberated through California and beyond, while here behind me, in the city that was once called the Paris of the West, it touched off a catastrophe.
Within about 3 seconds, the P wave, the very first announcement of the earthquake, had swept across San Francisco. And just 1 to 1.5 seconds later, the really strong shaking, what we call the shear wave or S wave, hit the city. And within seconds, lots of buildings were toppled and collapsed. The original death count was greatly underreported, and the documentation suggests as many as 3,000 people were killed. Out of a city of 400,000, roughly 250,000 were left homeless. Most of the actual damage to the city was the result of the fires that followed the earthquake.
Mary Lou Zoback is a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California, and an expert in Northern California's earthquake risks. We've come to downtown San Francisco so that she can better explain what happened here 100 years ago and what's likely to happen the next time a major earthquake strikes. Now, we're standing today at the San Francisco Ferry Building, which is a city landmark. We're at the end of Market Street. This was a landmark in 1906, too. What would we have seen if we had been standing here in the days after the earthquake 100 years ago?
Well, at the time of the earthquake, this would have been one of the worst places to be in San Francisco. We're standing on Bay Fill here, and that fill was not engineered fill. It was debris that the people in the city just sort of pushed out into the harbor. What happened here in this region along the Embarcadero, we know from photographs, the sidewalks, the streets were completely disrupted, broken up, because not only does the soft sandy material shake harder than in the rock nearby, but where it's water saturated, such as right here, it tends to liquefy. This phenomena, liquefaction, is akin to quicksand. So the soil can no longer support buildings. The streets were ripped apart. Huge cracks opened up. Basically, the area was pretty much impassable.
The earthquake changed the city forever. It also launched modern earthquake science.
Geologically, the 1906 earthquake was a really exciting event. I think all the scientists of the time couldn't wait to get out and go document what had happened, what they saw. And there was a report that came out of the study of that earthquake, led by Professor Andrew Lawson from UC Berkeley. And it's just massive. I mean, what they found out, they documented the San Andreas Fault as a continuous feature that ran the length of the state nearly. They were able to tell that shaking intensity not only varied with distance from the fault, but actually largely depended on the type of ground locally that a building sat on. So what we learned from their study of that earthquake really formed the foundation for what we do today in seismic hazard research.
Now today, if we look down Market, we see the high rises of the city's financial district. If this were to happen again, what would we be in for?
Well, actually, fortunately, many of the buildings that we see here in the financial district are relatively new buildings. Overall, these buildings should do fairly well in terms of remaining standing. However, all kinds of stuff is going to pop off the buildings and fall into the streets.
San Francisco's high-rises may survive the next big quake, but unfortunately, that's not true for much of the city's housing. A pair of studies of the Bay Area has found that nearly 40% of the city's housing, including many of the colorful Victorian-style houses that epitomize the city, could be destroyed in an earthquake. San Francisco's chief building inspector, Lawrence Cornfield, led one of the studies and explains why the housing is so at risk.
Many of the areas of the city where housing is built are areas that were not occupied during the 1906 earthquake out along the ocean, for example, but which had a lot of high-intensity ground shaking in 1906. There's also a structural issue in San Francisco's buildings. Most wood frame buildings are generally pretty good in earthquakes. They're lightweight, empty shells, and they have lots of interior partitions in them. The problem is where you have a large garage door on the ground floor, you have no support for the building when it rocks back and forth. These so-called soft-story buildings are particularly vulnerable to earthquake shaking.
It's not just a repeat of the 1906 earthquake that local residents have to fear. Seven major faults lie beneath the Bay Area, and these days suburbs have grown over many of them. From our vantage point at the Ferry Building, Dr. Zoback points out a number of the hazards facing the Bay Area.
What we're looking at today is a very dense urban community built around a beautiful bay, but because of that geographic setting, we're really at peril. So in particular, if we look at the beautiful Bay Bridge here, that bridge failed in 1989, and that earthquake was 100 kilometers away. We expect future earthquakes to be stronger and closer. The bridge probably won't survive the eastern span. It'll be another 10 years before we have the new eastern span built. The BART Bay Area Rapid Transit that runs underneath the bay in a tube, that's extremely vulnerable. It's sitting on bay mud that actually settled a lot in 1989. The operators of BART, they're concerned it will fail, and by failing, probably crack and water will rush into the tube. In total, what we're looking at is a huge catastrophe.
In 1906, this was an enormous earthquake, but the people who had been living here were somewhat used to this.
Right. Beginning in 1836, we actually had lots of earthquakes in the Bay Area. There was a magnitude 6 or greater on average every 4 years somewhere in the San Francisco Bay region. Probably the greatest socio-political legacy of the 1906 earthquake is the shadow that it cast on all the other faults in the Bay Area. This stress shadow is the result of the earthquake relieving stress on the San Andreas Fault, but also because it was such a large earthquake, it also relieved the stress that had been building up on all the parallel faults. So all our major faults actually had a reduction in stress as a result of the earthquake. But of course, since that time, we've been reaccumulating the strain. And at this point, we believe we are emerging from the stress shadow. So I think the 21st century in the Bay Area is going to be very different seismically than the 20th century.
Listening to Dr. Zoback, it's hard not to feel a sense of unease, knowing that stress is building underfoot in the Earth's crust. That stress will have to be released one day. It's simply a matter of when. How well San Francisco survives the next big earthquake will depend a lot on the science that began here 100 years ago, but also on how well we listen to what that science is telling us. For New Scientist, I'm Jessica Marshall in San Francisco.
And that's it for this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the April 15th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, The Ties That Bind. It's not just particles that can become entangled by the weird laws of quantum theory. It's empty space as well. Poles Apart. The debate over the use of mood-stabilizing drugs for people with bipolar disorder. And speed reading. Researchers unveil a new technology for sequencing a person's entire genome in less than a day. All this plus lots more science and technology, news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. SciPod transmission concluded.